So namaste, welcome to this second question answer session, which is all in the ego course. And we have quite a few to go through tonight, or whatever time it is where you are. Just a quick reminder before we get started with that, that anything that you do want to send in, it needs to be in 24 hours before the class. So the next Q&A will be back at 11 a.m. our time, like it was the first week. They alternate around the satsangs on a Thursday. So it will need to be in by 11 a.m. UK time next Wednesday, just to make sure we've got it. None of it ever gets thrown away. It rolls over into next week. So we've got a couple we're starting with that were from a little bit late to get in last week. So it's going to be in there. It might just roll into the next week. So lovely. So Shirley is going to be helping me this evening. Whenever you are ready, Shirley. Lovely.
Thanks, Helen. Okay, question one. The outside is an effect of our inside. Is the outside a film that is playing out? And when do we learn to be less reactive to what is in the outside and in control of emotions and centered in stillness? Then the movie will change? Question mark. Because right now I see a world moving towards a one world government, more control, darkness. If I stay in the now and don't concentrate on seeing these signs, will it then resolve somehow? Or is this split going on between 4D and 5D?
Thank you. So the outside, rather than effect, let's use the word reflection. So outside and inside, when we had the bowl of water and the glass, we saw that really outside is the same as inside. It is one, and they're not really two different things. So as you begin to, this is why lesson two is so important, as you begin to recognize that what we think we're seeing outside of us is really our own universal self, then we begin to be less reactive to it, because it's really like it comes to be clearer that if I am reacting to the outside world, then really it's like standing in front of a mirror and reacting to the image in the mirror, expecting the mirror image to change, and really getting upset when it doesn't. So the only way that mirror image can change, that reflection, is when we release some sense of limitation, some sense of separation inside our own self. And the key to this is to recognize that it's not me in here and everyone else out there. It is your own self. Everywhere you look, everything you experience, everyone you meet is your own self, the self, the noumenon, in disguise, if you will. And therefore, it cannot not change when you begin to recognize this. So as I come back into, if this is a world outside of me of which I have no control at all, then of course I'm going to feel very reactive, very upset by what I'm seeing. But if I recognize the chance, the power that I have to contemplate my beliefs that are holding me back, and when I say me, I don't mean a separate being, I mean me as in all of humanity. There is only one of us. As that begins to sink in, it's not that out there even is a reflection of in here, although we've used those words tonight. It is the same. So I can't contemplate anything or self-inquire and meditate and have a clearer seeing without it affecting, changing out there. And as we begin to see that happen, and we begin to experience a change in our relationships, a change in our body. Our bodies begin to feel a bit better, our emotions are a bit better, and it begins to affect the people around us as well. Our own contemplation begins to help other beings around us. We really begin to see out there, in here, same, same. It's only one. And you begin to feel more inspired, less reactive. You begin to, of course, you take whatever actions you need to in the world, but you recognize the power you have inside to really make a difference. And that is what comes from applying lesson two. I don't know if you remember, but I said, You might not understand it until you've applied it. And that really was the same for me. It just didn't make any sense that I could just ask a question in here and have some effect happen out there, some change. But when I began to see that it's not a separate being that's asking the contemplative question, it's the noumenon, in fact, asking, then that's powerful. And what we see going on out there really is the effect of our own, as a human race, our own collective unconsciousness, our beliefs. And as we contemplate those here within this group, this course, and spirituality in general, awakening and change is happening. We have to be willing to see how powerful we are, or else we'll continue to only look at the sources of information that are coming. There's plenty. I'm not saying to avoid the news. I'm not saying to put your head in the sand, unless you feel guided to do that. Not literally in the sand, I must say that. But all we see on the news and the media is everything that's going wrong. Just, and obviously there are things going wrong in the world. I'm not debating that. There are awful things happening. Just bearing in mind that the only news we get is bad news. That's all that's ever newsworthy. And without going on to too much of a rant, if you only look at Facebook and the news and all of that, you're only going to see bad news. So just balancing that against what you know must be happening. If your own awakening is happening, then something also must be happening across the globe, because there is only one of us. It cannot be otherwise. So I'll stop there before I go on for 15 minutes. Thank you, Cheryl.
Dear Helen, with regards to session one exercise of turning the attention back to the unchanging background of phenomena, what is the basis for the belief that the experience of awareness or silence discovered therein is not simply the experience of the causal body, which is also characterized by some of the same qualities as the noumenon, such as silence, no sense of space or time, not bounded, and no otherness, etc.?
Lovely. So I'm assuming when you say causal body that you're talking about some kind of subtle energy manifestation or soul or whatever word we're going to put to that. And so how do we know that what we're perceiving when we tune into, when we're aware of awareness, how do we know that's the noumenon? And how does that differ from, if I'm understanding your question correctly, how does that differ from something more subtle, or a subtle manifestation, such as our causal body? And my understanding of the term causal body, just so you know where I'm coming from, is a collection of everything that makes us individual, all our unfulfilled desires that we've brought forward into this lifetime, which are also our karmic patterns, and everything that makes us unique. But it is not, in fact, boundless. It is limited. It is finite. Only that which is everywhere at all times is the noumenon. And only that which is unchanging. So if we were to look at this causal body, even in this lifetime, it has changed. You have transcended things that you came into this lifetime, this body, mind, vehicle, at least with, not separate lifetime, but this body, mind, vehicle, you have used already to transcend some things, to let go of some things. You've probably gained new desires as well, as you've begun to realize awakening is not only possible, but happening. So that causal body doesn't change as much as our physical mind and body, but it is, or our emotions, but it is nonetheless changing. It is not also infinite. So when we look at awareness, when we recognize awareness is here, we tune into that awareness or silence, we can ask the question, where does it end? At first, when we tune in to listen to silence or be aware of awareness or any of those doorways, it's going to feel like the silence or the awareness is limited. It's my awareness. And when we really look at that, does that awareness come to an end? So if you were sat in front of me in this room here, would we really be able to say that at some point my awareness stopped in between the two bodies here? Would there be an imaginary line? Could we find an edge to my awareness where your awareness started? Is there really such a thing? And if we take something intangible like the space in the room, can we actually have an edge to it? There's an edge to any object, isn't there? But can there be an edge, a place where it stops when this is formless? So carefully and subtly noticing the differences between the two, causal body being a first manifestation, for want of a better word, out of the infinite self, the noumenon, the background, and the noumenon itself not being anything limited at all. It doesn't have any edges. And as you get to know the silence more, the awareness, whatever we're calling it, you'll begin to recognize it doesn't stop. There isn't my or your awareness. There's just awareness and all the body mind vehicles walking around inside it, thinking this is my awareness and feeling limited, but not actually so. So I hope that helps to give you a reference point. Only thing that is infinite is the noumenon. And what does it mean to be infinite? It means it doesn't stop anywhere. It must be present simultaneously everywhere at all times. And can we say that for the causal body? And can we say it's unchanging? And it doesn't meet either of those criteria. Again, I apologize if my understanding of causal body is different to yours. Hopefully it's not. But even if it is, that should give you some kind of way to double check there. Lovely. Thank you, Shirley.
Hi, Helen. I often get bombarded with thoughts that come from a place of fear or not being good enough, there being something wrong with me. When these kinds of thoughts are not present, it's easier to notice that I may not be these thoughts. But when they are allowed, it feels impossible not to listen to them and feel like I am unsafe and should feel ashamed. Could you please give me some advice for what to do in the moment when these thoughts are consuming my attention and when things are quieter? Thank you.
So let me start by saying it's very, very normal. And I'm really glad that you wrote in about this, because you'll be speaking for pretty much everyone on this course. It was the same for me as well when I was starting these intense barrage of thoughts where it didn't even seem possible to recognize the silence in that moment, to hear the silence. It didn't seem like I even had a choice. Tension just went with those thoughts and the resulting emotion that came. So first thing is not to beat yourself up over that. When there is then a moment of choice, so you might be lost in these thoughts for however long you're lost in them, but at some point there will be a kind of an opening up again where you realize I've just been lost in thoughts for however long it was. And what are you going to do then? Are you going to beat yourself up over that? Or are we going to just say, look, that happened. It happened and I couldn't do anything about it. And I would never choose to kind of go along with those thoughts, but my attention went there. What can you do about it in that moment? Nothing. There's a peace and an acceptance in that. It's not what we're trying to do to kind of somehow find a way to stop attention going there all the time. It is going to go with thoughts sometimes, or emotions that happen, as you were saying. So in those moments later, when you have some sense, and it could be 5 minutes later, 5 seconds, 5 hours, some sense of I've been watching thoughts, and you suddenly become aware you've been watching thoughts, then you can bring attention back to the awareness, the silence, the stillness, consciousness, whatever you're calling it, the self by whichever name, and just sit with that. And if you feel you want to, then I'd suggest going into some contemplation as well. If the intensity of the emotion is overwhelming when it comes, then it was much quicker for me to do some contemplation. Yes, I was very slowly gaining an ability to just turn away from all thoughts, but excruciatingly slowly. over months and months and months. And I wanted, I was always very impatient. I wanted to do it faster. I wanted to do it now. So I began to look at the emotion I'm feeling. So you've mentioned the type of thoughts. You've also mentioned emotions that come with us. You said fear, and I think you mentioned shame. So looking at those two emotions and start with it, whichever one is loudest when it floods the system, which one is most urgent, which one is shouting loudest in that moment, and ask it what it wants to tell you, and then turn that into a question. Is that true for you, even though I'm having the experience of it right now or whenever it's happening? Then you can still ask the question. Even though I'm experiencing it, I'm not going to let that dictate what I'm going to keep believing, because that's just an endless cause and effect cycle. Watching my experience, I feel more justified in feeling and thinking this way inside. Therefore, I keep experiencing it, and it goes round and around. And so a little bit of contemplation as well. If and when you can recognize you've been lost in the emotion again, you might not notice you've been lost in it for a while. But when you do get a moment of clarity later on, you suddenly realize, wow, I got swept up in that, but now I seem to be a bit clearer. Or when the emotion's diminished in its intensity a little bit, you might have some room then to begin to ask the question. You can also ask it when you're completely calm, you know, sitting at home with a cup of tea or whatever. It doesn't have to be when it's happening right then. It's useful to do it then, but sometimes you just can't. You're kind of lost in it, and then later you realize, whoa, what was that about? So fastest way is to find your way back to the noumenon, through one of those doorways. But if you find that the emotion isn't diminishing, or it's coming more often, or it's coming stronger when it comes, or all of those, then I'd suggest some contemplation on that. So I hope that helps. Thank you, Shirley.
I have been curious about what attention is. It seems in its subtlest form, it is awareness. But when it stops flowing effortlessly and becomes obsessed with phenomena, it seems like it belongs to the mind. Like you always say, it's not either or, but includes both. You said on day 5, nugget of wisdom, you simply tune in, and when you can enjoy how it feels to see yourself as you really are, then attention will want to join you in this beautiful place. It will come and sit down beside you and enjoy the view. Beautiful Helen, will you say a little bit more about attention? Much love.
Thank you. So attention, awareness, they're really synonyms. We could say that attention is awareness, awareness is attention. Or we could say another way to explain it is attention has two modes of functioning. It can look at something. So this is different to what your eyes are looking at. So your eyes could be looking at this image right now and your ears hearing these words, but your attention could be on what you're thinking about what I'm saying. So your attention is not necessarily where your senses are. And usually attention is on thought, a large percentage of our waking state. So attention has two modes. It can look at something like a thought, or it can look at nothing at all, meaning it's not condensed into looking at a particular object, and it's open. It's just, and we all experience this. It's not like a new thing, but doing it consciously is what we're aiming at here, where we're not particularly focusing on any object at all. And there's just openness. And whether we realize it or not, this is what we're doing when we focus on, we listen to silence, or we rest in the beingness, the presence. Where that presence is, it's not a thing that we can look over here at it or over there. It's just kind of diffuse and everywhere. So when we notice it, our attention is kind of in this open mode. And it begins to feel, after a little while, it begins to feel very, very nice to do that, to pay attention to something. Actually causes an awful lot of energy, because to pay attention to one thought or to an emotion or to something that's going on, a sensation in my body or something going on in my outer world. Again, not the same as what my eyes and ears are listening to and looking at. If my attention is fixated on a thing, which we, before awakening, we do this 100% of the time, we're always looking at something or we're asleep. Even in the dream state, I'm looking at images at nighttime and thoughts. And it costs us so much energy because we have to simultaneously ignore everything else. Everything else. We've just been doing this for so long, I don't realize how much it's cost us energetically. This is where bliss and the peace come from, because there is this surplus of energy then when we're not paying attention to anything. Then we've got all this energy back as life force, peace, bliss, that begins to kind of accumulate in the body, mind, and begin to feel quite content, energized, but calm, all of that. And so when attention is resting in this openness, we're not then able to react to anything as a separate being. That's also another reason why it feels so good. You cannot be aware of the contextual field and pay attention to a thought at the same time. Or you cannot rest in the stillness and only pay attention to an emotion at the same time. They're impossible to do both. We can pay attention to the field and the emotion moves inside it, or the thoughts are just passing by. But then all the phenomena have this different quality to it where they're just happening. And I'm sure you may have experienced this even momentarily. Things are just coming and going. There's a thought, it's gone. And there's no ability when attention is in this open state, not looking at anything in particular. You can do this right now. If you just notice the space in the room that you're sitting in, you know, my eyes are moving around the room, but I'm not focusing. If I notice the space, it's not looking at a particular place, is it? It's just here. It's everywhere. It begins to feel very, very nice. And after a while, we get kind of too lazy to pay attention to anything. And that's really what awakening is for me, when attention spontaneously reverts back to this openness instead of being the habit to go into this looking at something. And that happens even quicker when you realize there's no thing there to look at, meaning things I think I'm thinking about. We'll look at this more in lesson four, but what I think is out there, thoughts, emotions, my body, other beings, solid objects, are not really what we think they are anyway. They're all made of the self, from the self, appearances in the self. So the literal lived experience of there's nothing to think about means there's also nothing for my attention to contract around. I cannot suffer then. Because the suffering is caused only by contracting around an object that I think is there, my attention, and ignoring everything else. That just costs us so much that it robs the body of so much life force. And we call that suffering, which it also is. But I could go on about that a lot longer. But just noticing the difference between how it feels to really pay attention to a thought and then to really pay attention to the field, these two different modes of attention, and that it's just a habit for attention to, its default setting at the moment is to pay attention to something because we really think there are things there. And it seems to be that way when I think I'm a separate being looking at something else. But as that all begins to fall away, and even before we recognize that, just resting attention on the noumenon begins to be like a warm, relaxing bath, you know, with nice kind of bubbles and all of that. So anyway, that's hopefully enough to kind of feed your curiosity. Very, very intelligent question. Thank you. Thank you, Shirley.
Hi, Helen. I am enjoying contemplating the question. Is it true I can't have what I want now? I am also noticing how little I actually think about things these days. My sticking point at present is around participations in groups and online questions. I have always felt unsafe in groups, including family, school, retreats, and professional training. I have participated when necessary and even co-facilitated groups, but only because my desire was stronger than my fear, or the needs of the group enabled me to transcend my fear. I retired last year and was relieved that I didn't have to do groups anymore. I have excused myself from participation in online sites, etc., because of the time zones and New Zealand being out of kilter, but this is just an excuse. Is it simply a matter of contemplating the question, is it true I'm unsafe in groups?
Yeah, that question is a good one. It also might speed it up to look at what we're actually afraid of. And I totally get this. I totally had to look this one head on in the face doing what I do. It's very, very common that people have this kind of fear of speaking in front of or participating in front of a group of beings. And when I looked at this myself, I dug into it, there was a fear of being exposed, fear of being found out to be not who I need to be, so being less than I need to be, being unworthy. There was also a sense inside of being a pretender, for want of a better word, you know, some kind of fraud or something. And I think to a certain extent, we all have that inside us. So if we look at that in detail, what is it we're actually scared of here? What is it, you know, I might make a mistake and then I'll be embarrassed in front of everyone. And if we look at our egoic sense of self, it might be in a complex human brain that it's thinking, but a lot of our egoic thinking is very, very simplistic terms, almost animalistic primal. So for an animal in a herd or a group to be embarrassed, to be found out to be not good enough, or to be ostracized, banished from that group, was usually meant death, didn't it, to that animal? If a family of animals have depend upon each other and suddenly you're on your own, then that was often a death sentence. So of course we're, you know, reasonable adult humans, but our ego is still thinking this way inside. If I make a mistake or say something, then I'm going to be embarrassed, first of all, ashamed, and I will be in danger is the next conclusion, which is where all the fear kind of comes from with that. So I've got to be someone I'm not, and I can't quite manage that is ego's mission. And this is going on throughout our entire lives, but it's kind of highlighted and exposed in a group situation, isn't it? Because and especially if you're speaking or something like that, presenting, all the attention is on you. And that's quite a spotlight to be under. So just really looking at that in terms of separation, you know, are there really any others? And I really applied this one. Are there any others to judge me or to be embarrassed? Or can I make a mistake anyway? And the more I came to see what's actually talking through my mouth now is not a separate being, the more there's a trust and a faith in that. And it's great that you recognize that you've been holding yourself back, and there's that urge to kind of, the desire was stronger than the fear, but it'd be nice to also do it without the fear, wouldn't it, to be able to participate like that. So maybe just have a look at what it is actually that the fear is saying. What is it saying? Would, you know, what's the worst case scenario? You get on a group, you say something, and it's completely something. Somebody asks you a question, you say something that's totally irrelevant, or something you feel really embarrassed, ashamed, and all of that. And same time, my mind is sure that everyone's judging us, you know, and looking at that, is that actually the case? Do I really know what everyone else is thinking about me? Or do I only know what I think everyone else is thinking about me? And they are two extraordinarily different things. Can that person on the group who's watching me contribute, can they really know me either as a separate being, as a person? Or do they know what they think about me? So you get into this thing, he goes, terrified of being judged and all of that. But really, we're all working through the filters of our own thoughts until we're not. You know, I could think that I know you, but I don't really from the egoic level. I know what I think about you, and you know what you think about me. Who's to say how much of that is reality, if any? And just because it is in thought, it's diminished completely from the original self. It's completely, totally unreliable in terms of actual evidence of what someone is like, what we think about them, even what they think about themselves. And I'm saying this because it helps us to lose our fear of judgment. You could be Jesus Christ and walk into this group, and someone might still have a negative opinion of you. You could be somebody that they'd never heard of before and say something profound, and they would love you, you know, because they think they know you based on how you make them feel. But how they feel is dependent on what thoughts they're believing. So I really got this. I'm just laboring this point a little bit because I lost my fear of being judged then. Of course, I was starting to realize as well, there isn't anybody else to judge me. It's a self-reflection. I stopped judging myself. People are a lot nicer to me in my outside world through the mirror image we were talking about. So I hope that helps. Just looking at what the fear is really specifically about and then sort of diving in from there. Is that true again? Thanks, Shirley.
Question from last week. I have started to see all sorts of spiritual things in movies, songs, nature, poetry, fairy tales, symbols, actually everywhere. The world speaks to me. Is this the noumenon, a normal part of awakening? Can I trust these messages since it is part of an outer thing?
Yep, it's very usual. In fact, it's been going on all the time. We just haven't been able to pick these up because if I am everywhere, then it makes sense there'll be signs and messages everywhere to encourage me and things like that. And sometimes it's fun to play with a phenomena like this, the manifestation. You know, if I'm not sure of a decision, I can ask for a sign to help me. Can you trust them? I would always go with how they make you feel. So when you see a message or a sign, how does it make you feel? And your body is excellent for giving you real-time feedback on that. So, and we're doing this all the time. Everything I'm saying to you now, you're taking that and weighing it how it makes you feel inside, and then weighing how it makes you feel inside, and then assessing how much of that you want to take in as truth. And we're doing that all the time, unconsciously, of course, or consciously. So we're doing that with everyone. If somebody said something to you, let's say you've always got on with your neighbor's been really nice, and then you meet your neighbor from across the road, and they say, I don't like that person next to you, they did this. And that, you know, might feel true to them, but it doesn't feel right for you. It doesn't sit right because you've always had good experience with this person living next to you. So you're going to weigh how what they're saying makes you feel and take some of it that's useful and leave the rest of it. And you can do that with these kind of signs and messages. But they are absolutely everywhere all the time. As Laurel was saying before we got on the recording with the I am message in the, I think it was the car in front of you, but it is fun sometimes, you know, the numbers seem to line up 7777888. I remember one night looking at my clock and it was 1:11 and then 2:22 and then 3:33. And then I wish I could get some sleep. You know, I didn't see 4:44. So yeah, it is fun. And it's a symptom of the oneness that you are really everywhere. You know, how could you not get those signs and messages if you are really everywhere all the time? Thank you, Shirley.
Dear Helen, I have a question about energy in the body. If the noumenon is everywhere and in everything, how does it relate to life, to the life force energy that is only in living things like human body, plants, animals, etc. Is that energy different? I can understand inanimate objects like cushions being part of the noumenon. It doesn't stop when it comes to the edge of an object, but it doesn't give them life force energy that is present in living things. Thank you, Helen, for taking my question.
Lovely question, thank you. Well, the same energy is in everything, whether it's animate or inanimate, and you can see the effects of that energy when it's appearing as a sentient being, such as a human being. You can see that effect more, but it's the same energy that's holding that basic shape together. So what is it that determines when the body dies? And really, it's when we're done holding that shape together. And birth is when we begin to kind of hold that shape together of that body. And of course, this body's changing and everything, so throughout the course of its life. But the same thing is happening even with a rock or a tree. You know, at some point, that rock is going to begin to, it'll take a lot longer probably than a human body. It'll be here, a big boulder, a long time after the human body's come and changed and then gone. But so at some point, the physicists call it entropy, I think. Never really got on with physics as well as chemistry, so I'm a little bit, I think it's entropy. Basically, the chaos of everything is always trying to come apart in manifestation, and it takes energy to hold it together, a particular shape. Everything's always in motion. So it is the same energy, really. We tend to call it life force when it appears in something, an animal or a human being. But we can see that same energy, intelligent energy, in a plant as it turns towards the sunlight. We can see it in animals, you know, they have their own little ways of being, their own emotions in a way, and all of that. So same energy, same process, any form that appears is going to be here for a certain amount of time in the same shape. But even that same shape is changing, isn't it? If you look at your body, it's completely different to how it was a year ago, and how it was at birth and all of that. So it's the same one energy, the first kind of manifestation, very subtle manifestation of energy in and as all things. But we can see its effects more, I guess. They're changing faster. If you could watch the lifespan of a rock, we took a small rock or a boulder, and somehow you could time-lapse that, you know, throughout forever, you would see a change and eventually break apart. And everything in manifestation is recycled completely back into some other form. That's just happening faster and more visibly in a more perceptible way with so-called animate sentient life forms. So I hope that helps. And if it doesn't, just ask again. Thank you, Shirley.
Hi, Helen. Thank you so much for the teachings. Listening to replays, I always absorb deeper and deeper. I've been practicing an opening to silence and being in the now. What is silence? Thank you. And I'm deeply grateful that you are sharing your awakening process. Sending you much love.
Wow. What is silence? That's a big question, which I can't really answer. It is, I'll have a go. We can explore what silence is. If we listen now, we notice silence is here. Then we can begin to explore. It can begin to move and begin to We can begin to explore what silence is. Where is that silence? You can hear it. Where is it? What is it? Is it a thing? So I can notice where my hand is. I can say it's here and now it's over there. Can we do that with silence? Where it's here, you can hear it. But where is it particularly? Is it somewhere Can you point to it with your finger? Is it inside, outside the body? Can we say, does it have a location? Could you point to where it is on a map and say, that's where the silence is? Or that's where it isn't. It isn't there. It's here, but it isn't there. Is it a thing like my body is, or my thoughts? Is it a phenomena? Does it end anywhere? Does it begin? We can check this out. If I'm hearing the silence right now, has it just begun because I'm listening to it? Or has it always been here and just now paying attention to it? Maybe attention tends to go to the words, the phenomena, the thoughts appearing in it, first and foremost. And silences, when I deeply investigate, I fell in love with it completely. I absolutely fell in love with it, silence. And it was quite frustrating for my mind because my mind couldn't grasp what it is. It could only say what it isn't. It isn't a thing. It isn't visible. It isn't even audible, is it? It doesn't sound like anything. Actually, I'm hearing the absence of any phenomena. That's what I'm hearing, phenomenal sound. And it isn't tangible. It isn't perceivable by my senses. We'll look at this more in lesson three. It isn't in any particular place, and yet it's here. And it isn't coming and going. It's constant. I just thought it was coming and going because there were seen to be sounds punctuating it. Just kind of looking, and it's blurring like this, begins to become clear. And we can do this with any of the names that we're calling the self. What is silence? Where is it? Is it inside of you or outside of you? Is there a you and it? How are you noticing it? Am I hearing it through my ears? If it doesn't sound like anything, if there's no sound to it, silence, then am I hearing it through my ears? What do my ears hear? They hear sounds and vibrations. I could go on some long 10-minute speech about some beautiful poetic thing about what silence is, try to describe it, but there are no words that will ever, you can only really describe what it isn't. We can say things like it's everywhere, but even that is kind of giving it a location that it doesn't really have. It's not somewhere, and it's certainly not really everywhere. Those things don't really mean anything in the silence. Without a body-mind vehicle, is there a reference point for where it is anyway? If I'm not measuring something from the body as being a central location point, then where do I stand in everywhereness? So it's really good that you are... lovely that you're kind of falling in love with it. Only someone who's falling in love with silence would ask such a question. What is it actually? And I just really urge you to dive in and fall in love with it. And not in love like we do with, you know, falling in love with someone, but in similar in a way, you want to know everything about it. You want to explore it. You want to experience it. You want to experience it all the time, again and again and again, like that. And it'll just begin to show you what it is. It's very powerfully stable and present and reliable. And you can, every day you can get to know it deeper, what it actually is. And it might never be something you can put into words, but it will be a very beautiful way to spend your existence. So hopefully that helps to kind of give you some way to explore the silence, to get to know it better. And just dive in there and have fun with it. It's here, but what really is it? Thank you, Shirley.
Okay, so this is the last question.
Okay.
Dear Helen, thank you so much for your teachings. You have such a clear and succinct way of teaching. Since I first took this course in November, many issues have seemed to worsen in my life, mainly persisting health issues and difficulties in my 46-year marriage. My husband tends to overspend and asks for large sums of money from my savings. He also tends to be aloof. I have very often wondered, if I left the marriage, would things improve? I guess I wish to know if this is due to my karmic patterns, and will see these situations improve if I deal with the underlying beliefs. How would I know if it is the best thing to leave the marriage? Sometimes I think I hide behind religious beliefs, having been brought up that way, instead of being strong and decisive. I hope this is clear. Thank you so much.
Let me just say how very brave it is of you to send that in. And yes, it's due to karmic patterns, but it helps to remember that karmic patterns, causality loops, whatever we're calling them, that it isn't just your karmic pattern. It takes two human bodies to play out a karmic pattern, or a human body and something else like money or time or something like that. So it's easy to mistakenly kind of go, if I change in here, then he'll change out there. And again, we're flipping the cause and effect on its head then. I am the cause of the issue. And if I change, in effect, what we're saying out there will change. But if he is you also, and you're contemplating on some belief that you've begun to see in this, then the situation for both of you must be different. And I would suggest, same as we said on Sunday, to look at what emotions come up from this. So you said that the situation is around sort of finances and sometimes the way he can be with you. How does that, what emotion is brought to bear when that is happening? And maybe there's two or three in that. Looking at the emotion or emotions and asking what the story is behind that. Sometimes when money is involved, it's usually a safety or security kind of feeling, not feeling safe and secure. Because, you know, you can have all the savings that you want, but you can't rely on that if it keeps being spent like that. So again, this karmic pattern is playing out for both of your body-mind vehicles. And as you, your body-mind vehicle, ask the question that you find from the emotion, it has to begin to change. And the reflection, as you move to the left, you're standing in front of the mirror and you move to the left, so does the reflection instantaneously, can be no other way. What that may look like in and as your marriage is either your husband will begin to change also, or he won't, and there'll most likely be someone else that's better suited for you. Most likely, he will begin to just release these habits. We've seen time and time again healings in relationships like that, just through contemplation, because both of you are caught in this loop of playing out this cause and effect cycle unknowingly. And it doesn't matter which body mind vehicle the two of you is most conscious and can ask the question, it will help both of you. As to whether you should leave or not, only advice I could give there is, can you ever really know until you've transcended these cause and effect loops, these karmic patterns? How can I know what the true depth of a relationship is with a particular being until we have released all these cause and effect cycles we're going, karmic patterns between us? Only then will I know what the relationship actually is and looks like between us as possible. And a relationship where I don't need anything from this other being and they don't need anything from me. They don't need me to stay with them. They don't need me to make them feel safe. They don't even need me to love them. But there is love there anyway, and there is security in all of that, where it's coming from the inside of me and pouring into the relationship, and the same from the part of the partner. It is a very different way to function where I don't need anything at all. I'm not asking anything energetically from that person. And from that place, it's stunningly clear whether you're supposed to stay together or not. And even if you're not from that place, it will feel like a joyous thing. Okay, we have come as far as we can come together. We've learned as much as we can from each other. There's a great mutual respect and love and appreciation and just an understanding it's time to go our separate ways. Ending of a relationship, even a marriage that's been for so long, doesn't have to be a negative thing if it's coming from the truth. Most times it just is that these karmic patterns have been playing out between you both, and you've never really had a chance to experience just being married to each other, just being with each other, really, without the limiting beliefs of ego in that. And what's that like when they're gone? Or when they're not affecting you anymore, you're not caught in them. So it's very, very common for some things to come up more strongly, as you're saying. And because it's coming up more strongly, shows me that you are living your as a self more, as a noumena more. Your understanding has deepened what you really are. If it hadn't, then this cause and effect cycle you're stuck in, the two of you, the one of you, wouldn't be bothering you so much. It wouldn't be so out of alignment with what you know yourself to be now. So we're coming to a relationship thinking that we need security or approval or acceptance or love or whatever it is that we're looking for, and that works while we're a separate being. But as we're seeing clearer, there isn't anyone to get it from. This other being is myself. And also, it's not really true that it's missing anyway. I just haven't really known how to look inside for it and allow it to come forth. Then the whole thing, I'm willing to go out on a limb and say I've shift to a whole deeper level, a level of intimacy and love and connection that we never thought was possible. It is available to all human beings, whether it's a romantic relationship or any kind of relationship. So I hope that helps. It's a very common question. Thank you, Shirley, for reading amazingly as always. Lovely. What we'll do is, I see your hand up there, Laurel. We'll just take a quick 5-minute break and then we'll open it up for Q&A. We'll go to Laurel first. Let me just stop this for now. Thank you. I'll see you in...